Great pleasure to have with me Mark Rubinstein for another conversation about the wonderful newsletter he writes every week, Net Interest, a letter on financial sector themes. And last week, Mark, you wrote about regulation, a somewhat a dry topic, but you made it interesting. The title of the essay is The Policy Triangle. We'll get to what that means specifically a little bit later. But why don't we start with just this idea that policies are basically trade-offs?
Well, thanks, John. Let's go a little further back, actually, and look at financial services as an industry, because it's a special industry. Banking in particular is not like other industries and has to be regulated as such. The classical regulatory trade-off that policymakers made was between competition, which is the fundamental ingredient of any market economy, and clearly is very present in many other industries, most other industries, all industries, on the one hand, and financial stability on the other, because fundamental difference between banks and other corporate entities is that if another corporate entity, you know, my analogy often is the supermarket industry, if supermarket A runs into trouble and goes bankrupt, actually that's typically a good thing for supermarket B, who will take up that market share. In the banking sector, which is inherently a much more networked sector, that's not the case. And if Bank A goes bankrupt, that's typically very bad for Bank B. And as a result of this, financial stability is a factor that policymakers regulate according to. And the trade-off they make is with competition, because typically the more competition there is, and one can look through history at multiple financial crises, they're not all necessarily caused by competition. But competition is frequently a key ingredient in the way they play out. Because often what happens is that when banks start competing, it leads towards excessive risk-taking. In an effort to remain competitive, they can relax credit standards and their incentives to monitor loans, and importantly, maintain long-term relationships with borrowers, diminishes. There's excess credit then gets built up, and soon enough you have a problem. And certainly that was the fact pattern around the global financial crisis, 2007, 2008, 2009. It was the fact pattern around savings and loan crisis, fact pattern around the Scandinavian financial crisis in the early 1990s. Very, very common with some kind of deregulation event, some kind of liberalization event, which then allows more competition and ultimately leads to financial instability. So this trade-off between financial stability on the one hand and competition on the other hand is something that policymakers keep front of mind. And it's, I guess, competition clearly is to the benefit of consumers, ultimately, through greater efficiency in the system. But the flip side is that the system itself is possibly jeopardized by too much competition. So it's a trade-off between the entities within the system and the overall system itself. And it's a trade-off that regulators in other markets and other industries don't necessarily have to make. It's a very specific trade-off to financial regulators.
Well, that's a great point you make on competition leading toward excessive risk-taking. I guess nobody said it better in the heat of things than the former CEO of Citigroup, Chuck Prince, in 2007, when he said, as long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance. Famous last words, as it were. The point you also make is when there is a head-to-head a standoff between competition and stability, that regulators do choose stability, and you list some examples to back that up.
It's a really good point, and I think it's a classic market deceit that competition is the premier underlying force that regulators will typically optimize for. And certainly it's a factor that is front of mind in Silicon Valley. A lot of the disruption that is happening in financial services today, a lot of the new entrants are coming to market on the principle that they can be more competitive and provide better services to consumers. That may be true, but the regulator doesn't necessarily see it from that perspective. And I've put it very bluntly, make no mistake, in a head-to-head, as you suggested, John, between financial stability and competition, regulators will choose financial stability every time. Now, the problem right now is that financial stability seems a long way off as a risk. There's very little sense of vulnerability to financial instability right now. And that's a function of two things. One, it's because of the apparatus that was put in place post the global financial crisis, Dodd-Frank, all of the various regulations, which had something of a stress test in 2020, which they survived. The banking system not only survived in 2020, it to a degree thrived. But financial stability is absolutely key, and they will choose financial stability over competition every time. The other factor, I guess, is that we're at a cyclical point right now where everything feels fine. So there's this sense that everything feels fine. Obviously, there's a lot of capital being invested in disruption, but it's a kind of a bottom up process, which at some stage will collide with the top down regulatory process, which is to put financial stability first. And the examples I've given, we can go back. So let's go back to the global financial crisis in 2008. The UK banking sector was a fairly concentrated banking sector anyway, certainly more so than the US banking sector or banking sector in Germany, for example. HBOS was one bank, it was in trouble, and the merger was announced between HBOS and Lloyds TSB. Now, between them, these two banks, two top five UK banks, retail banks, would have had a third of the checking account market in the United Kingdom. And this was a problem. Typically, competition authorities would frown upon that. And indeed, the deal was referred to competition authorities, who concluded that such a merger would lessen competition in the market. But they were overruled. The ultimate policymaker, in this case, it was the government itself. And I'll quote, overruled it. The deal went ahead. It's now a large bank under the name of Lloyds. And the quote was, "The public interest of ensuring the stability of the UK financial system outweighs competition concerns." This is one example. Now, clearly, that was in the heat of crisis. But there have been other examples since. A more recent one was in March of 2020, when we were confronting the pandemic-driven recession, when the aid packages were announced across the world. And I'll use the US as an example here, but actually it was the same in the UK. In both markets, the regulator said, we want, and I'll quote Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary of the US. He said, any bank, any credit union, any fintech lender will be authorized to make aid loans to small business subject to certain approvals. And he said that in March. But the approvals weren't forthcoming for the fintech lenders. And in fact, the whole first round of PPP in the US went out without fintechs getting their fingers on it at all, without it passing through the hands of fintechs at all. And same in the UK. In the UK, the authorization of fintechs to process aid-oriented loans was very, very slow. And the reason here, arguably, is that it's easier for the regulators to control four or five, an extreme example, but certainly a handful of known, trusted financial intermediary incumbents than to layer in lots of unknown incumbents, lots of unknown startups, which may be positive for competition, but is less positive for financial stability, which they're trying to maintain at these points of crisis. And the examples go on and on. Money laundering is a fascinating topic, money laundering, because there are arguments that the cost, the anti-money laundering costs that all of society incurs outweigh the benefits that, quite frankly, the criminals are getting away with it. And there's research that's been published which shows that 99% of illicit gains are retained by criminals, but the 1% is just not enough to offset the cost of capturing. Clearly, the objective is to capture more than that 1%. But there are estimates that $180 billion is actually the global cost of compliance against anti-money laundering. That's a big fixed cost. And the benefits of fixed costs, who are able to absorb fixed costs, are the incumbents. So again, indirectly, perhaps in this case, the regulator, it's less about stability, maybe more about market integrity, that in order to retain market integrity, the policymaker is pushing down onto the sector such high fixed costs that only the incumbents can bear, and the new entrants cannot. So lots of examples, and I think, you know, certainly where we are in the cycle right now, where financial stability isn't top of mind, it's important to remember that regulators will always choose it over competition.
And then you get to a new dynamic here, which is the entry of technology companies into financial services, which does throw off the regulators' trade-off framework. Tell us how.
Well, this is interesting. So technology companies have entered the financial services industry. They've done it particularly in Asia and in the case of China. So Ant Group is now, we'll talk a little bit more about Ant in a while, but Ant Group is now considered a financial services company. But don't forget, it started as an offshoot from Alibaba out of e-commerce. Amazon and Google both do payments, and they have joint ventures. They have relationships with financial institutions to do credit. Facebook is entering the financial services industry, both through payments, for example, via WhatsApp in Brazil and in India, but also through the launch of Diem, which used to be called Libra. They changed its name, which is its payments initiative, global cross-border payments initiative. And so none of this is lost on financial regulators. Financial regulators, they can see the entry into their industry, into their regulated industry of technology companies. And to a degree, there's nothing new. Again, if we go back to the global financial crisis of 07, 08, 09, a lot of it was put at the door of non-banks, shadow banks. And in many cases, some of the slip-ups occurred because regulators didn't have a handle, financial regulators didn't have a handle of the risks that were accumulating outside of their regulated domain. So, great example in the US was Washington Mutual, which went bust. It was regulated as a financial, but it wasn't regulated as a mainstream financial. That was regulated by the thrift regulator, which was not to be rude, it was a kind of second rate regulator relative to the mainstream banking regulators, notably the Fed. This is new. The difference this time is that these technology companies have advantages that even the shadow banks didn't have, largely around data and the way they use data. Now, the bankers have been complaining about this for years. Bankers have been, whether it's the head of Santander, whether it's the head of UniCredit, whether it's Jamie Dimon at JP Morgan, they've all been complaining about this playing field not being level, because tech companies are able to come in and do financial services, and they can't go in and do e-commerce. And actually, there's a data mismatch as well, because certainly in Europe, where there are data sharing regulations in place, there's a kind of an asymmetry in there, such that the tech company can come in and get access to the financial data, but the financial company can't get access to the e-commerce data or the social data or the search data that the tech company has. So they've been complaining for a while about this asymmetry. Regulators now are starting to agree. And the point here is that there's a number of points. So the first one is they don't regulate the technology companies. Now, they regulate their activities. Amazon can't just do payments. It has to have a payments license before it does so. Facebook, in order to launch DM, needs a license from the Swiss financial industry regulator. That's their chosen regulator. So they need licenses for their activities, but they don't need to be regulated at the top of the house the way banks do. And banks have increasingly been regulated along those lines since the financial crisis, with more capital requirements and so on. So that's one issue. And then the second issue is just this idea of data, that they have all this data and they can use it in a way that banks can't use it. And back to the point about trade-offs, that creates two new trade-offs into this equation. So your classic traditional trade-off was between competition and stability. And now if you add a third node of data, it creates two new trade-offs. One is privacy against competition, and two, through data. So through data, the idea that private providers, tech companies, can use data and create a more competitive market. So maybe they can do better lending with that data, but there are privacy concerns associated with that. And the other trade-off is between stability and data. If all that data is out there, it's a great resource for the financial regulator, particularly around anti-money laundering to be able to get an in-depth understanding of how the economy is working in real time. So two new trade-offs: the trade-off between stability or integrity and data, and then the trade-off between privacy and competition. And the problem is the financial regulators don't really, this has to be there. The problem is that they don't have jurisdiction to A, regulate tech companies, and B, to monitor issues such as privacy and data, which are the responsibilities of other regulators. So it could be that we've got a scenario brewing, not unlike the shadow bank scenario of the mid-00s, where regulators don't have a handle on the overall marketplace and are unable to, although they can articulate these risks, they're unable to do very much about it.
Well, certainly will be interesting to watch how all this develops. Another really interesting dimension is the international dimension. And you mentioned Facebook choosing FinMine Switzerland as its regulator, or you also cite the example of Afterpay in Australia, which it sounds like hasn't been regulated at all due to Australian laws. Can you shed just a little bit more light on that dimension of it?
Yeah, it's interesting. So that's right. So buy now, pay later is an emerging technology, if you like, within financial services, a substitute possibly for credit cards. And there are a number of players globally. Affirm, which IPO'd quite recently, Afterpay in Australia, which is public, and Klarna, which is based in Sweden, but is very prominent throughout Europe. At least it is in the UK and also in Germany, which is still private. And they're all regulated quite differently. So Afterpay in Australia argues it kind of falls in the cracks. There's no regulatory arbitrage. There's nothing new about that, that companies choose either the most lenient regulator or they are able to circumnavigate regulatory laws, all of which tends to work when they're small, because when they're small, there's no financial stability risk. But as they get larger, and a point I've made in the past when thinking about financial technology, this idea about kind of invisible asymptotes on growth, which is, in the case of financial technology companies, I think it is regulation, that the regulators will let them do whatever they want beneath a certain size. But when they hit a certain size, then they get captured by regulation. And so Afterpay could be getting close. Afterpay, it's skirted between the regulations. It says it's not a credit provider because of the structure of its lending products, nor is it a payments company because the way it structures its payments processes. But the regulators, and in the UK as well, just 2 weeks ago, the regulator came in and said they want to regulate buy now, pay later a bit more. And another example here is Ant, which I said we'd come back to. So Ant in China came out of Alibaba. It's now a phenomenally successful, massive financial technology company. And it's regulated in payments with a payments license, in credit with a credit license, in retail brokerage with a retail brokerage license, and so on. But up until recently, at the top of the house, it wasn't regulated as a financial. And actually, Ant went out of its way to argue with potential investors on its IPO roadshow, which was aborted because its IPO got pulled, that they weren't a financial company, that they were a technology company. They coined this new phrase, TechFin, rather than FinTech. They changed their name from Ant Financial to Ant Group. And they wanted to be covered by sell-side technology analysts rather than financial analysts, which, by the way, is a feature of most of these tech IPOs, fintech IPOs. Clearly, very, very well-publicized issue around Jack Ma, its founder, and a big bust-up with the Chinese regulators. The upshot is that as of last week, so sometime in February, they are now going to have to be regulated as a financial holding company with all of the capital and prudential requirements that go along with that. In their case, they went beyond the kind of size, but ultimately that's what's happened in China. And it feels like it's a interesting precedent for what could happen to other financial technology companies elsewhere in the world.
If that were the case, if some of the technology companies, let's say in the US, that have dipped their toes into financial services such as Google or Amazon, were eventually regulated, not just in terms of their activities, but also the companies themselves, do we have any sense for how onerous that would be and whether it would actually change their ability to conduct their business materially?
Well, in the short term, so actually there is a case that it's going to come quite soon to Google and Microsoft and Amazon, because they run cloud providers, and most of the financial sector increasingly, and this accelerated post-COVID, have been putting more of their data into these public clouds. And the financial regulator is getting a bit nervous about this, that too much of the infrastructure of the financial industry is now sitting in data servers, on data servers that are maintained by Google and Amazon and so on. And actually, there was a story back in 2019 that the financial regulators went in to inspect Amazon's facility in Virginia. Now, they're used to being treated very, very well. I'm not sure a red carpet is necessarily rolled out, but they used to be treated very, very well, certainly post-financial crisis, by banks. They weren't treated that well, apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, by Amazon. This was a short while before a massive breach of Capital One's data, which has led to calls that these companies are treated as systemically important financial market utilities. Now, we spoke last week about DTCC, which is one of them. There aren't that many. There are very few. There's a handful of, I think, eight possibly, of designated systemically important financial market utilities. And there are, to your question, there are various standards imposed on them. Now, for a big company, those standards they're not insurmountable. They're around governance, around independent boards, around proving resilience, around operational risk. Certainly in the case of the banking sector, operational risk is measured and capital is required to be held against it. In the case of these companies, it's not insurmountable. It's material, but it shouldn't, it, unlikely to have that much of an impact, certainly from an investor's perspective. But it's a wrinkle, it's bureaucracy, and it's something that certainly in the case of those three, we could see, well, who knows what the timeline is, but certainly it's on the radar.
Well, with that, Mark, I think we've covered the policy triangle, getting back to the title of this week's issue, with the three angles being one, obviously, stability / integrity, the other, efficiency / competition, and that's where that traditional trade-off has been, but the new angle being, obviously, privacy and consumer protection, where a lot of these new challenges arise.
That's right. And the issue, when you brought up this topic by talking about it being possibly a dry issue, regulation is, but it's important, particularly in the financial industry, when there's a lot of new entrants coming into that industry. At some point, the regulators will stop and take stock.
Absolutely. And as the CEO of PayPal, Dan Schulman, has remarked, with the industry growing more complex, you're really seeing a collapsing of financial services, shopping tools, and payments. So this will be fascinating to watch. Thank you so much, Mark, for your time this week.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
Goodbye for now.